So Amy was just sitting there with a with a microphone on a floor going, I'm going to record my third eye into the podcast. That was great. I like that. Let's do that.
What I actually said was, I'm going to put the microphone on my third eye and let's see what comes out. That is actually what I said.
Okay, cool. I like that. Yeah, no, I just started record. Why not?
Okay.
Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the End of Seeking podcast on the episode, whatever. I'm not even going to say what episode because last week we started to record, but it just didn't, we were both in a bit of a funky mood, so it didn't go well and we didn't put it out. So that
we've just been both traveling for a couple of weeks.
The mic stand is wah again. Okay.
Martin. Anyway.
So yeah, we've both been, last week when we tried to do a podcast,
we've been traveling for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, and
we're
family, both, friends,
yeah,
travel,
just
events.
Exhausted. And we came back, we hadn't even been back 24 hours or something, and we're like, right, let's do the podcast. And that was not going to fly.
No, I was fried.
And we always find this, you know, it takes a little bit of time and integration, particularly when we spend so much time together, when we come back together, having spent extended periods of time apart. There's always sort of this adjustment,
got to process what's just
the changes that have occurred, and because things move so quickly and you may not notice it when you're sort of together in that movement. But it's like when we move separately, you know, like away from each other for periods of time, it's like it takes a while to catch up to those changes that have occurred. So
yeah,
it's always an interesting process, I find.
Well, we're both hermits, you know, we keep asserting this. It's just,
it really is true.
We're, you know, introvert hermits.
Semi-reclusives.
Yeah, I you know, I've heard this about introverts and extroverts and that kind of idea. The last couple of weeks I've been, you know, spending time with family and friends and doing that, but immediately, you know, after, it's great and the energy's there and I enjoy it, and it's a nice change from, you know, change of pace. But then I have to recharge in silence, you know, I have to really, really kind of retreat into, just to let that process through my system. That's, and you know, the difference is, you know, I think extroverts get their energy outwardly, you know, from social connections and whatnot. And
yeah, they feel nourished and filled up in their heart from that.
Yeah, and whereas introverts, you know, gather themselves and recharge in silence. So anyway, last week didn't work out. So here we are. And I was just touching on something. This is completely random. I was, we're talking about perennialism as a viewpoint, or as a kind of spiritual perspective, and I heard it a lot, you know, perennialism. And in fact, I'd go so far as to say that, you know, at some times I probably would have identified somewhat as a perennialist. The idea, as I understand it, being that, you know, beneath all the spiritual and, you know, religious traditions, there's a truth that's present, that basically all religions or spiritual traditions are saying the same thing. But the more I've sort of explored different spiritual traditions, there are a lot of commonalities. Also there's some really fundamental places where they just don't meet, where they're not saying the same thing. The eschatologies that, you know, their telos, their goals, their are not kind of the same.
Even the we've talked about this before, the sort of the inner teachings versus the outer teachings.
Yeah.
You're saying even within the inner teachings, there's some fundamental differences.
What I say is that it's reductive to say that they're all the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's not quite so easy to say that. I'm not saying there's necessarily different.
Venn diagram. And so there's some crossovers, maybe.
And you know, what I would say is ultimate reality is ultimate reality, and perhaps you know, so I definitely have sympathy for a kind of a perennialist viewpoint. The perennial wisdom is that, you know, the truth is the same underneath all the different expressions, and then I'm very sympathetic to that. And but anyway, but I learned a new word the other day, which was great, and it was from a guy called David Bentley Hart, who's a fascinating Christian. Yeah, he's a religious scholar, a theological scholar. He's a really smart thinker on this stuff. I think his tradition is Eastern Orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. He's an American, but he's very smart and very erudite. But his tradition is Orthodoxy by choice. But he's a scholar of languages, ancient and modern. He's a philosopher generally. He's a writer of, you know, even fiction. He's a profound intellect. With a lot of heart.
Good combo.
Yeah, good combo. Touch more in the theological than I particularly want to dwell. But my point is that he's a well schooled in Vedanta and, you know, different Eastern spiritual traditions. So he knows. So he came up with this word that I loved and. Syncretism, rather than he was making this point that the perennialism is a sort of a reductive thing, whereas syncretism. And I went, he said, I think myself as a syncretist, and I go, what's a syncretist? And then
and just for everyone listening, Martin is a lover of the etymology of words.
Oh, yeah. And so I was going, well, words generally, are beautiful things. So I went looking at syncretism. It was only a brief look at it, but it's more the view that, so say if you're a sort of a syncretist, you know, spiritually, then it's this idea that you can take some aspects of truth and expression from some traditions and some from others and somehow, you know, make something of that, that's a kind of a combination of the teachings and the insights, rather than sort of reducing them and say, oh, underneath it all, it's just the same thing. And arguably, the ultimate reality is ultimate reality, but it's a more, it felt truer for me that because I think of, you know, I use Zen in my teachings, I use Taoism, I refer to, you know, Vedanta and Christianity. It's like I am syncretic.
I think that really speaks very much to me in terms of seeing how there are different teachers who are seemingly talking very much at odds, pointing to the truth in ways that don't necessarily... or rather they can contradict each other. I was going to say they don't necessarily add up, but they contradict each other even. They'll go as far as to say that. And for me, it's the way I would describe it, because I also often find that even in the words that come out of me, it's like there can be contradictions there.
Yeah.
And the way that makes sense, for want of a better word, is that it feels to me like an infinitely faceted gem.
Yeah.
Truth. I'm saying truth.
Reality,
feels,
yeah.
Truth
yes.
Feels like an infinitely faceted gem, and all that we're sometimes able to do is describe a facet which is revealed to us.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that the another facet, say on the opposite side of the gem, in this infinitely faceted gem, is not revealed to us, but is revealed to someone else.
Yeah.
And so to them, that truth is just as true.
Yeah.
And it is truth of the same truth, yet it is a different facet and it is seen in a different way and has a different fragrance to it, has a different emphasis to it, and applies in different ways.
It makes me think of languages and if you speak one language and that's your native tongue, all you know is that. And you can only know the realities, let's say, or be aware, cognizant of certain realities that there are words for. And, you know, you start looking at different languages and you see, oh, there's language, there's words for things in the different language we don't have words for.
Like cwtch.
Well, cwtch
is a Welsh word, C-W-T-C-H.
Yeah.
Fantastic word. Yeah. Love the word cwtch. There's actually quite a few words, but yeah.
Another great Welsh word, hiraeth, which is something like longing for home, longing for, but it goes deep. It's longing for the familiar. It's something, but that's all.
It's a home that you
the sense of home.
Yeah,
maybe.
It's not a home that you necessarily know, but it's a home that you feel.
Nice, right. So I mean, that's a lot of sentences to explain one word.
And which means it's a cuddle, but it's more than a cuddle. Yeah. It can also be a room in the house. Can be a couch
and a sense of being coziness, which is cozy up. And I mean, I think it's close to the Scandinavian word. I think it's Danish, maybe the hugger, H-U-G-G-E. It's like a hugger. It's like cozy. So I guess there's, on all these languages, there are different words, and they can't actually be reduced to, there's not different words for things. It's not strictly equivalent. There are, you know, expressions that aren't present in other things. And so to say it's all the same is actually a little bit reductive, and it just doesn't allow us to live in the real variety of expression by saying, oh, it's all the same, and that's the word for that, and that's the word for that. Yeah. And there's something richer going on. Mm-hmm. And it's about living in that diversity and syncretism is just you know, using, you know, oh well, that tradition or that says this about that, and that feels, I mean, literature too, you know, poetic expressions that aren't, we were talking about this the other day, they're not, you know, you use a poetic expression which evokes a mood or points in its way to a state of being or a condition of being or something. That's not a technical.
No, it would take a whole book to explain, and yet you read out a poem of it, a few sentences, a few words even sometimes, and you feel the fragrance of it, the sentiment of it. We were talking about this because I've been writing a lot of poetry and just talking about how generally my sort of, I'm sort of letting myself live more into that sense, or being called, I would say, into that more poetic sense of language. And it's not accurate. You can't pin it down. You can't.
Well, it's a different mode of feeling and communicating, right?
Yeah, it's much less accurate, and it is much more about feeling what is being spoken about.
I think it's I'm not schooled in Western philosophy very much, but I would like to be more classical Western philosophy. But I know this idea of I think it's Eros versus the Logos. You know, the Logos is this, I think I'm getting this right as a pairing. The Logos as the intellect, as the structures of intelligence, that in some sense they're literal, they're semantic, you know, to do with meaning and that kind of thing. Whereas Eros is of the heart, and it's the expressions of the heart, and it's not technically, you know, logically true. It speaks to a different order of understanding.
Yet if words spoken from the heart are met by another heart, that heart knows of what the other heart speaks of. And if met the heart, the words of the heart met with the mind then goes, this feels like a riddle, what's going on here?
Well, I remember I was back in the early days after my shift, was tweeting a lot because all these expressions were coming out, and I was quite rhetorical back then as well. You know, rhetorical flourishes of, you know, poetic inspiration, let's say. And there was a non-dual guy who I actually that, to be fair, the conflict we got into, such as it was, and we had a long sort of online discussion about it, was began a kind of a mutual respect between us, which was nice. But at the time, he was critical of, let's say, my rhetorical flourishes, mm-hmm. you know.
Your poetic flourishes.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
And they were poetic, they were, you know, but they were, came from right from the heart, and they were speaking of, you know, expressions of my reality as it was arising. But, you know, they weren't maybe, from his point of view, technically, and he was really caught up on this, you can't speak about this non-dual thing, this awakening thing, unless you're purely technical about what was the implication.
Yeah, the implication being, if you're not that, you are adding to occlusions yeah. and confusions yeah. that people experience yeah. in this realm.
But I was like, well, what about poetry? What about literature? What about, you know, the expressions of the heart that remind us, you know, bring us into remembrance mm-hmm. of
which to me that is what awakening exactly. is a remembrance.
What does it take? That's why literature is so rich. I mean, someone like Rilke. Mm-hmm. It's just staggering, and Rumi, exactly. I mean, these aren't technical non-dual manuals, but you do this, you do that, you look at this. This is the structure of reality, and there is an absolute place for those logos, mm-hmm. the absolute place for it. But also the heart singing out from its own bliss, from its own insight, in its own language. Carrying the transmission of being, it's it has its own quality to it, and they both have their place, definitely. So, you know, that syncretist view is for me more interesting because it allows a wider range of. Well, years ago, there was a book. Years ago, when I was young. I was introduced to Richard Bach's book, Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Great book.
And it's a kid's book.
Actually, Illusions was my...
That came second. I'll get to Illusions. That's what I'm talking about. So I was introduced to Jonathan Livingston Seagull. And it was such a simple tale, but very, you know, beautiful and deep and profound. Oh, fantastic. And then Illusions was the second book. And that was just fantastic. And, you know, what was it called? Illusions, the story of a reluctant messiah or something. It was just the two pilots. And of course, back then I was really into flying and all that stuff. Anyway, it was part of my awakening of sorts, you know, introducing to ideas, expansive, that reality wasn't as we kind of imagined it to be. But anyway, there was just one quote. I can't remember what, it was the story of this guy who was basically enlightened, you know, but flying around, and Richard Bach, I guess, or whoever was kind of just conversing with him. And he quoted something, I can't remember the name of the reluctant messiah, but he quoted something, and it was from, I don't know, Mickey Mouse or something. He goes, really? Really? You're quoting that? He said, I'll quote truth where I find it. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And it's that idea, like, it doesn't matter where it comes from. Does it resonate? Does it contain that truth? Does it express some truth? And I like that, you know, the multifaceted gem of that is reality. It can't all be reduced to equivalence, different aspects. And you have to, it's like in some way, the Hindu or Vedantic or whatever, the Vedic view of reality is Satchitananda. The ground of reality, the self, is Satchitananda. And those are, it's three things. It's like, it's, you know, being or truth, and then chitta or consciousness, and ananda, which is bliss. But why is it not one thing? Because reality can't be reduced to... It is one, but it's irreducible. There's a certain point where it's irreducible. And it's almost like the Trinity in Christianity. You know, mm-hmm. there's a viewpoint of the three, quote, persons of God. And it's like, why not one? Why not singular? And I guess it is, but it that is. Singular contains, it is irreducible to sort of these...
qualities.
The dynamics of that.
Or in what we were brought up with, Rishi Devadas and Chandas.
Right, the three.
Devadas and Chandas.
Right, the three aspects of the interplay of these the structures of reality.
Yeah, the knower, knowing and known.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're nominal. They are not separate.
They are the samhita of that is the oneness.
Yeah.
But these, when at the moment of expression, it necessitates.
They are
something
different sides of the same one coin in some ways. It's like they're different aspects.
Yeah.
There are fundamental aspects of experiencing that is not separate, but there is a differentiation there somewhat.
Yeah. Differentiated but not fundamentally separate.
Exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, learned a new word.
Always a good day.
So we had a question from a friend. Oh, you've got it?
I do have it. Yes. Hold on.
Let me just sip some coffee. Yeah, go
ahead.
Should
I read the whole thing?
We'll just read the relevant parts. He was asking us.
Listening to all of your conversation, enjoy them a lot. Okay. They also spark some questions around the topic of integration. How do both of you live this truth on a really practical, mundane level of existence? How do you respond to the demands of life while being fully surrendered in non-doership? For me, it seems that by not controlling my ego, I allow myself to keep certain unhealthy, maybe even addicted habits for longer than needed. On the other hand, I do not want to use control to act against my desires, but that paradox keeps me a little bit stuck sometimes. Or how is non-doership playing out for you when life wants you to do something, the dishes for example, but you feel no desire to do so? Where is the balance between surrender and self-control, or between non-doership and conscious manifestation? Anyways, thank you for the podcast.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot in there. Thanks for the question. Appreciate it. He's asking what on a practical level, how does that look like? Let's say doing the dishes. That's a good one. Without overcomplicating it, the dishes get done when the dishes get done.
Absolutely.
If like I'm sitting on the sofa and the impulse to move me happens or it doesn't. And that's actually, this came up quite early on after, it was one of the first things that really appeared after the shift was my morning habit of getting out of bed, for example, was characterized by a lot of inner dialogue about, I should really get up now.
You're a night owl, not a lark.
I'm a night owl. So I, you know, don't necessarily have to get up at any particular time, any particular way. There were times where I did have to, but at this point, you know, getting out of bed or waking up, and then that gap between waking up and actually getting up, characterized by a lot of inner dialogue about, oh, I should get up now. Oh, I'll get up now. Oh, when I get up, do I need to get up? Yeah, maybe I do. Oh, I better get on with it. Come on, get out of bed, right? Mm-hmm. All this sort of internal dialogue.
Probably increasingly... not distressed, but increasingly as the moments go on.
Come on, get out of bed. All right, just 5 more minutes, all this. And, you know, almost immediately after, one of the signs that something had really shifted was that dialogue was gone, just gone. And all that happened, I remember waking up, laying in bed, being there, and then at some point getting up.
Happened.
Moved. And that's that. So that my answer in part to this is that so much of the question is still predicated on the idea that there's someone choosing or doing. And that's a function. I'm not to say there's something you have to do. It's a function of observation, a function of recognition. There can still be some habits. Some habits of saying, oh, how take control, my ego or whatever.
That's just a commentary.
It's the commentary.
It's a commentary, and often that commentary still can play out for a very long time, particularly if it's unquestioned. If there's a commentary that is still a habitual commentary of an I, yeah. of I'm in control, I need to do this, I've got to do that, how do I do that, I'm going to manifest, I'm going to change, yeah. I'm going to do. If I don't, there's going to be, you know, bad behavior. If I, all of this commentary is actually in many ways irrelevant.
And the commentary is a claim though, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, often it's like, oh, I can, I need to get up. I should do this. I'm going to do this. Right.
Yeah. And if it's not, if that's not questioned.
Yeah.
And looked into. Inquired and again, into, I want to even go even deeper than that. It's like, if you can, if there is the impulse, and maybe this this conversation will serve as that impulse to go, huh, yeah, maybe there isn't something I need to do. Maybe there's no one that can do it other than just there's this commentary going
on. I
noticed
that there's reality, let's say, what's happening. Laying in bed in the morning, not got up yet. And
or dishes that need doing.
Dishes that need doing, and therefore the movement or not towards that. What's actually happening? And then, but so then this prior claim: oh, I should, I could, I can, I must, or
it's
mustn't.
It's the could and the can that is really
it's presumptive, though, isn't it?
Well, it's pernicious as well, is because the and that's what to me is the unexplored assumption here is that you could and you can.
Yeah.
And this idea that you that even that you're consciously manifesting.
Yes.
For me is worthy of a second look at.
And a third. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just keep looking.
Keep looking. Is that really what's going on
what's
here?
Happening?
Who is consciously manifesting? And that's the question. Who? Who is consciously manifesting?
Yeah, and that presumption that there's anyone consciously, anyone or even, right, so let's break that, consciously manifesting consciousness, absolutely, there's the ground, manifesting, well,
it can be happening.
What's happening, true, but is
and
there,
that can be
is
a description of something that's happening, is it is manifesting.
Yeah, no, yeah, yeah. But, and this idea that then, this is where the observation of true non-doership comes, and from true inquiry, you notice things like the presumption that, oh, I'm desiring to bring about an outcome. Mm-hmm. Well, even that desiring is arising spontaneously.
Exactly.
So you can't get behind consciousness on this sense. You can't get before it. From where would you manifest?
Yeah.
You know, consciousness itself is your own ground of your own reality, the seat of your own, quotes, identity is who I am, what I am, what, all that. And I go, well, if I as consciousness choose to manifest, I don't even see that consciousness chooses anything. It just simply is a function of my nature that all of this comes to be.
Including the apparent seeming choice or non-choice.
Right.
So even that is spontaneously arising. The idea that I choose and therefore I can choose correctly or incorrectly, while on the surface level, the relative experience of life certainly can look and seem that way.
Yeah.
But without a closer look at that, it's very easy to miss that actually even that is just a function of spontaneous manifesting thoughts in consciousness, as consciousness, from consciousness.
Exactly. You've got to get into this inquiry of, do you choose your desires or do they just show up? Do you choose your impulses to move or do they just happen?
Yep.
Your thoughts, your feelings and sensations, at what point are you choosing this?
And there may well be an overlay on top of that that says, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, you should do that, you should do this. And there's, I think, where this person, just knocked my microphone, sorry. This person, I think, there's maybe some leftover unexplored pockets of things there. Because, I just want to circle back to the practicalities of living with this and in this, you know, because this person's asking about, you know, the balance of surrender and self-control. To me, surrender, I've bumped into this, and we've had so many conversations about this, but I've bumped into it so many times. in both in my own experience and working with other people, of where people assume surrender and non-doership is basically a non-doing, or okay, I'm just going to lie in bed and nothing's going to happen.
Right, you'll be a couch potato forever because you're not doing.
Yeah, and actually, it's not about surrender and non-doership is not about non-doing. It's about the surrender and the no-doer.
Yes, it's the end of the doer, not the doing.
Yes, exactly. And so actually, to me, true surrender includes running a marathon. You know, like right. It's like, okay, my feet are running a marathon right now. Yeah. All right, here we go.
It's surrendering to the fact of what is right now, and that's it. And it's yes.
And also, I want to touch on this thing of, you know, this person brought up this idea of addiction and habits, and I think we have to be careful there of assumptions that habits are wrong, as in they're not serving a purpose. Yeah. To me, where there is a continual functioning on a certain level, it may be an addiction. And I'm not saying that's an easy or a good thing in terms of the quality of life within that. But we cannot be too quick to assume that there's a wrongness in that fundamentally. Rather, I would say, is that there's some lesson that is playing out there. And
yes, which itself is a necessary unfoldment.
Exactly. And again, that we have this overlay of a commentary that says, oh, I shouldn't be doing this. If I just control myself more, then I won't be that way. And actually, there's a danger of missing the lesson. And of course, here we go into a deeper recognition. There is no danger of missing the lesson because you can't.
No, and I think that's the solution. The solution to this is to go to the deepest level.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise it's provisional. I mean, we talk about surrender as let's say a practice or as something that's offered up. You need to surrender or whatever. You know, at that level, it's a provisional teaching. It's like it's speaking to the person,
to the doer.
But slowly but surely, and this is where it gets a little bit matrixy, is that. That even though on the surface you say you need to surrender, and some person goes, "I'm surrendering," and it feels like a personal thing, it's actually not personal. Even then, even the provisional personal thing, it's how the absolute, how our absolute being is playing out, is through personal surrender until the personal disappears.
And but it's it was recognized never that personal. That absolute state. I'm not sure if that's the word I want to use, but anyway, I am. That absolute ground is that of surrenderedness.
Yeah, it's the condition of surrender.
Exactly. So it's an unveiling or a noticing or a remembrance of the surrender that our natural beingness is. And the instruction to surrender is almost like life giving up a reminder or a post-it note of you need to surrender.
But the fact that you're doing it, the fact that you are, say, participating in personal surrender.
Well, who's the one?
Exactly. The fact that you're doing that, as we talked about this before, is as Augustine would say, is the outward sign of the inner grace.
Yeah.
And that's the power of that. So even though I'm practicing meditation, actually that practice is still the absolute doing it. It's just, again, it's about the claim.
Yeah.
It's about
it's and an
talk
overlay,
back
yeah.
into the non-doership. You do talk about, I need to do the dishes. I should do the dishes. I'm going to do the dishes. And then I get up and do the dishes. And so you think that it's that you're being responding to the thoughts. It's an overlay. The thoughts are the egoic thinking is a claim. And
it's part of the process. It's not divorced of that. It's not, you know, we have this idea of this causes A causes B, and so those thoughts are causing me to get up.
They are woven in there, of course.
That's
you
what
see,
I mean. They're not
right?
divorced. It's
an
not.
Overlay, but it's also woven into the fabric of the spontaneous playing out of being.
And so, I'll speak from my own experience here. Anyway, it's not that the quietening of that overlay happened immediately, although relatively speaking, it did. quieten down significantly pretty soon. Yeah. But it's not that that overlay has to be always silent or completely gone. But I would say for the most part, it is very lightly experienced.
Yeah.
And it, if it is there, if that overlay, if that commentary is there, it's seen for what it is.
Yeah.
And because of that, I would say for the most part, there's this, again, it's not a choice, it's just what's happening. There's a sense, it's how I would describe it is like, is life's kind of gone, okay, she doesn't need that overlay anymore, she gets it.
Yeah.
And so it actually, the effect is it has quietened down. And so personally live my life very quietly internally. I mean, you know, driving along the car, I just got back from driving for a couple of hours going, picking up something. And it's silence is driving the car. It's not me, Imogen, driving the car. There's not a commentary that's falsely taking ownership of the fact that Imogen is driving the car. I mean, obviously this mind body is what is actually is functionally on that level driving the car.
It's emptiness. It's not separate from the functioning of reality itself as it's playing out.
And so there's no doer there. It's just doing. It's just
happening.
Exactly. It's just what's happening. Car driving is what's happening. Doing is what's happening.
So you could say something like in response to this, look more closely and actively at what's happening, and then put in brackets if you can. Exactly.
Always if you can. You need to write that caveat and everything. Yeah. But the fact that someone may be listening to this conversation is like life's, that's how I see it anyway, not just our conversation, but anything that puts that mirror up to us that goes, maybe look at that closer, or maybe have you thought about it in this way? Is life's functioning, providing us an in of clearer insight and a testing of the tires, you know, kicking of the tires of our assumptions. And I think this person talks about integration. I think post-awakening, that is necessary. And that can take time to really hit into all the old conditioned habits of functioning, and to really kick those tires and see all of that functioning clearer can take time, because sometimes you don't even hit into a certain scenario and that reveals where there was a blind spot of seeing clearly there, that of actually how it is functioning versus how you thought it was functioning, how thinking believed it to be so.
And I mean, I bump into it myself. In fact, something that's very pertinent now, and you know, because I'm always feeling into the tissues of this, you know, because that's part of what the contemplative mode is about, just settling back into the tissues of your own interiority and watching and observing how these things play out. And you know, absolutely. And that's the devotion to the bliss of that inner process,
truth, to clarity, but not in some cold hard way, but it is like a love of life to be clear.
So you know, it showed up to me actually just quite recently in regard to my writing and just noticing the thought processes. I mean, this is partly, I noticed the thought process, noticing how they comport with the reality as you are. And one of them was this idea of procrastination, for example. So I'm sitting there and I'm writing all this stuff on mostly a daily basis, and I've got like a million words floating around in my my hard drive that need sorting, and
quite literally
yes, not hyperbole, not an exaggeration. No, and you know, there's wheat and chaff there, just to be clear. But there's this idea that arises, I should be posting some of this more, posting it. And that idea of, so this is it, that idea of should is such a nest of vipers, right? It's this presumption that, one, I'm autonomous, and therefore I can make a choice, Yeah. Like, do or don't do.
And then you're failing.
All right, that. If you don't. Yeah. And so choices get made. But always, so this is it. So I can see these flutters of thoughts arising. But as you talk, you know, the sense of being itself is the dominant. And so the obviousness of, oh, this is the even these thoughts are just happening, for one. Mm-hmm. And then they're just thoughts. And they're not actually real. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't make sense. And the knowingness of all things come as they come, when they need to come, perfectly, without any choice on anyone's part. Yeah. And what I do notice is this beautiful orchestration of reality. And I remember someone wrote once, it was some productive, you know, blogger or something. But I liked what she said about, she said, I don't believe in procrastination. Because, you know, you read a lot of these, you know, productive and self-help and don't be, you know, how 10 ways to, you know, beat procrastination and strategies and all that. And it's all founded on so much, such a thicket of personal views. But her viewpoint is actually
false personal views.
Well, by definition, yeah.
I just want to put that in there. Cause yeah.
What personal is. My point was about procrastination. I don't believe in it, because this idea that, just on a personal level, if you're not doing something that you feel you should, first of all, you need to question why. What's the should in there?
Where's the motivator?
What's that? Well, what's that should based on?
Yeah, like motivator.
An ideal desire for an outcome.
Yeah, that's what the motivator is the ideal outcome. Yeah.
Yeah. But the notion that the reason you're not doing it, let's say, you might have an outcome. I want to do this. I want to get this out. I want to finish this job or do that kind of thing, or wash the dishes or post.
Or someone else might have some expectations that you get exactly. something
but
done.
But anyway, it's a contrary. But the idea that it's not going out because somehow you're blocked, mm-hmm. when her view was, it's just not ready yet.
Yeah.
When you're ready in yourself, when you've processed what you need to process, when you come to the right understanding, the motivation to act, mm-hmm. is a system-wide thing, and it's a natural. It's you'll naturally be inspired to act. So basically, you know, what I would say is sit and watch yourself, you know, in regard to washing the dishes. And practically speaking, one of the first things I experienced when after this was watching myself move from this place of pure aware observation.
Yeah. Silence.
With no thought to it.
Yeah.
And that's how it goes. And I forget about it sometimes because I'm just acting from that, you know, generally. But there can be pockets.
I think where it gets tricky, and you touched on it there, but where it gets tricky is in relation to others and the expectations of others. Because it's one thing to sit into the silent pocket of being and notice when actually there's an impulse to move coming from within. Okay, now this feels like the right time. And that's a really hard thing, to trust your own sort of rhythm. I was talking to someone back and forth online about this, I don't know, last week. And to trust your sense of when something is right for you, that rhythm is a really, really, really difficult thing. We're so conditioned, it's so hard. But then you add into the mix, and that's an internal non-trust of your time, your own timing. But then you add into the mix
the demands, expectations. Yeah.
When you should get something done, for instance, my expectation that you should do the dishes by this time today, you know, like these kind of things.
Well, the social conditioning all around all the time.
Exactly. And so then it adds an entirely different layer of complexity to how to trust yourself, how to stand in that. And what it does is when you really, this is lessons I'm still learning and lessons, you know, I'm still seeing clearer and clearer. It's like when you really sit into the trust of your own rhythm, you have to be willing to be seen as bad in the eyes of the other who is acting on their conditioning that is running the show that they haven't necessarily seen. Because what's so beautiful, and I notice it with you and I, when you're both very clear on that there is no doer in all of this. And I see we bump into this all the time. Like, we want the other to do something, but ultimately we both understand and see, and it actually becomes quite a delightful cosmic joke of like, well, we'll see what happens.
And
at that point, there's where the surrender comes in, is the surrender of, then we see, we let go and we surrender outcomes, and we trust that whatever outcome does happen is necessary and perfect. But that's hard to do when there's only one person in the equation that gets that, that sees that. When both see that and get that, and that's what I'm saying, it's so beautiful. I see that between ourselves all
the
time.
We're watching, like, let's see how this plays out.
Yeah, and often then it's even when one really wants something to happen and the other one, you know, can't bring that about, there is this sort of joy of it that feels more light and playful, and a sense of wonder of what will happen.
Well, this
rather than when you're interacting with someone who really does genuinely believe that, one, they are in control, and two, therefore you are in control and should be in control, and you're being lazy, you're being remiss, you're being bad, you're being uncaring. I mean, we could go on with with the narrative of what that may look like individually, but that's a whole other level of complexity in terms of learning to trust yourself.
Well, this was a big shift, but part of what I've had actually come to see over these years is often within yourself awakening. It suddenly you're in a kind of a non-conceptual naturalness, and that's all well and good. And then you bump into other people who aren't, and people who are very much driven by outcome seeking rather than the natural trust and flow of life itself. And you know, people, outcomes that they desire often feel desperately and, you know, important, like they have to come about. And so, so when you, often I found, you know, getting into interaction with people who are tight, who are graspy, who do want, and not just something for themselves and within themselves, but something from me, you know, some way that I have to function to satisfy them. And now that's a problem, because I can only go my own way now. That's the interesting part about, I talked last week about the possibility. What would it look like for a world where those graspings have dissolved, where we're more or less awakened when people are interacting? And so this is in some ways what we're living out, just the two of us here. Mm-hmm. It's a great lesson in what sort of awakened mutual living looks like.
Yeah.
What the dynamics of that.
For the most part, it's wonderful, actually.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just want to, again, I'm always trying to go to the deeper ground there, that says even those that are, let's say, blind to the fact that they're not in control and therefore living out in those tight outcome-based fear control ways, even that is just a function of consciousness playing out in the way that it must, to provide the lessons that it must for everyone involved.
Yes, indeed.
And so on the deepest level, even that is a non-doing. Even that is just... Yes. And once you see that, all I find left in my heart really... two things. One, compassion, that everyone is literally living the cutting edge best of what is possible in that moment for that individual being expressed as it is.
Which is inevitability.
Yeah. And two, this is a cosmic joke of it all. Yeah. The humor of it all.
Yeah, fair enough.
The lightness of it all. And not necessarily to say that all circumstances you're laughing at, you know, someone might be really severely, you know, suffering. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying I walk around sort of going, ha ha, you're suffering. I'm not saying that.
No,
but
no,
I am saying that when met with the reality that all is perfectly orchestrating, and not necessarily easily so, as in it, you can really be moving in challenging ways. And I, you know, even with this deep understanding and knowingness that all of this is just playing out, you know, I've gone through in the last years very challenging things as well. It's not, you don't get to skip over that stuff. That stuff doesn't disappear. It's just there's a sense of surrender and an openness to what is. There's a sense of, for me, the word I use is curiosity. There's a curiosity of what is this that is showing up in my life? And it's not about trying to analyze it and figure it out, but it's about being open and listening to life in a way that doesn't assume you know, that doesn't assume that why things are the way they are is wrong. It's just that they're playing out that way because there's some necessity of what's happening to further and the deepening of growth and wisdom.
Well, I mean, this is the difference between sort of the viewpoint of the small self and living from the big self, is that life itself is the little self just doesn't know, but it thinks it does. The egoic thinks knows what the best outcomes are and tries to organize life according to
it's
those.
It's like a little kid.
Yeah.
Thinking
whereas,
it's in charge.
Whereas the big self is naturally orchestrating everything towards its own, let's say, evolutionary outcome or growth. It's moving in that direction. So, you know, although suchness, the perfection of reality as is in every moment is true and a given, also the manifestation evolves. It just transforms, change, evolves. And that's part of its process.
We just have to be careful with the tendency that most, certainly the small self has, but
it's just it doesn't know.
Take the ownership of, I am manifesting.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. and I know better and I can bring, I have a bugbear about things like co-creation. I know a lot of people aren't going to like that, but the law of attraction and manifestation, all that, it just doesn't add up. It doesn't go deep enough.
It's true on a partially, provisionally, relatively true on a certain level, but it's a pretty thin level, I would say. It doesn't go very deep. I don't mean thin.
It because ultimately, sure, one thing attracts another, you know, on a you know, relative level, but you know, we're talking about liberation here and seeing, you know, the ultimate truths and recognizing the fundamental unity of all reality.
And manifestation and co-creation as a description of what is happening is one thing, but ownership of I am co-creating and I am manifesting, other than just
who's
a description of this body, this mind is that it's coming through that. You have to fundamentally ask the question, which you just did: who is the one that?
Who's
is,
the I? Yeah. And then we found that the I itself, if any I could be posited at all, is the singular reality itself.
Yeah,
that is probably better described as simply spontaneously functioning in its own dynamics.
Yeah.
You know, consciousness spontaneously stirring in its own nature.
Yeah. And that consciousness is playing out with what we call this mind body. Sure. Yeah. And if you want to say that this mind body is doing that and therefore that equates to manifestation, sure, we can talk about it in those levels.
Yeah.
But if you haven't,
you're talking about a superficial point, though.
Exactly,
you've come out of your own ground, let's say, or your analysis and your you know, ideas about what's happening is one step beyond that ground of spontaneity, the ground of non-doing.
Yeah,
it's not just to say that the person isn't doing, the universe isn't really doing, you know, consciousness isn't really doing. It's all just happening, and that's the. That's the
rather
it's
not a doer. The doing
is not
happening.
A doer.
Yeah.
Doing, you know, doing is nominally happening. But
that's why I prefer, and I know you do too, is the word happening is a less sticky way of describing functioning of experiencing rather than doing. Presumes a doer mostly.
Well, this is it, and this is what I keep coming back to. Find out the one if you are positing action, doing, personhood, just go and find that, bring it forward if you can find it. And that's the whole, this is the work of self-inquiry, is actually to drill down into what's true. It's not about accepting any particular viewpoint. It's about just keep drilling down until you get to bedrock.
You can get to that bedrock and really have a very established,
which ironically direct, is formlessness. But
yeah, exactly. You can come to that deep understanding of your true nature and yet still have pockets of assumptions playing out. And we've already mentioned this, but I want to just really mention that again, because I think it's worth mentioning that post-awakening. So the awakening to your nature, that of true self, pure consciousness, awareness, divine nature, spirit, whatever word here. So there's a true and real cognition, recognition of that as your own nature.
Yeah.
Yet, on the relative, there can still be very much a playing out of pockets of unclear seeing and therefore seeming functioning that has an effect on the relationship of life and can create, as I'm sort of sensing in this message, a sense of suffering, even if it's even if it's a subtle and relatively minor sense of suffering. I mean suffering in terms of at odds with what is, subtle sense of no, not this, and a contraction of life. Even if it's nested within this great openness and this great wealth and depth of knowledge of one's own nature, which can be very fundamental and very, very true, very real in the experiencing. I know who I am. I know what this is. I know what this reality is. Yet, paradoxically, there can still be some unseen pockets of assumptions and habits and conditioned views that play out for a long time.
Which is to say, in some sense, that there are thoughts that arise within one's consciousness that if combined with belief in those thoughts, you can feel them in the body. And so that what we call that suffering, that dissatisfaction, is in fact like you're believing something that isn't true. Yep. And so you kind of got to identify what that is. Oh, yes. And it's only like...
Which is harder said than done sometimes.
exactly. That all this said about, let's say, the wrong notions regarding doership and personhood and how that acts out.
And control and all the rest.
All of that. It's okay, I think, to have that dance of personhood still continue on in a relative sense. Like we're dancing with this. But as long as that doesn't overshadow... The reality of the deeper truth of the ground. And so if you start to feel it as a sort of a suffering or as an imposition or as a feeling in the body,
it means heaviness
or even a sharpness or just something. Maybe it's a sign that come into remembrance again of the drop into your reality, see it for what it is, bring some awareness to that, to that feeling and that thought and that idea, knowing from your own very being, this is just a thought.
Yeah, from that context, for me, that's where you are able to meet that thought. It's like you're not meeting on the level of thought, you're transcending into that bigger space of your true nature that then gives rise to the clear seeing and the inclusion of the thought. And to see it, the level in which it is actually a relatively superficial level. And yet it doesn't need to be excluded or gotten rid of or changed. It's just
notice.
You see it for what it is. Yeah. You notice it.
And sometimes these thoughts are accompanied, correlated with some really, really... I mean, this is let's say, the dualistic life. It's like a lot of these thoughts regarding who I am, what I am, mm-hmm. As a person, therefore doership, what should be done, what shouldn't, mm-hmm. you know, all this kind of stuff.
What's good behaviors, what's bad behaviors. Yeah,
exactly. Those can really be accompanied, those thoughts mm-hmm. can really be accompanied by some very intense energetics.
Somatic.
They're embedded. Yeah. So to challenge what seems to be challenging a thought is actually... coping mechanism that's been embodied.
Yeah. And so you have to, in many ways, meet it on all levels.
Yeah.
You're called to meet it on all levels, whether, yeah. you know, again.
It takes work to sort of release and unpack and to even be able to approach some of these yeah. thoughts. That's why the work of, you know, self-inquiry in a seeker can be really challenging. So what we're talking here, though, in a sense, is a bit of cleanup.
Yeah.
So post-awakening, there can be still some pockets. And there can
There's
be
a
some,
big myth. That and, is a massive yeah, no, myth.
Still, there can still be rather intense pockets.
Massive,
but,
yeah.
But, you know, I arguably, with the catalyst of awareness more easily brought to bear, mm-hmm. and even on the energetics and the availability of non-grasping can help these things release. And so in this case, this idea about, you know, the confusions about doership and stuff, just pure observation, be aware, bring awareness to the idea, to the ideas that the mind's presenting, see if it's true.
Is it true? This is a great question. This is always a great question.
Yeah, but somatically,
exactly.
Feel through those.
It's not things. About trying to come to an answer that makes sense, because you got to remember the mind is very limited. It's a beautiful tool, but it's a limited tool. So you have to use all tools available to you, which is mind, body, and spirit.
I think what's interesting between this has come up a lot of times over these podcasts is this difference between provisional and definitive teachings. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, and I'm spitballing this, but it's my experience, post-awakening, provisional teachings feel wrong in me because they don't describe truth properly. And not just provisional teachings, but provisional statements on the nature mm-hmm. of reality. Mm-hmm. You have to hold them as provisional. You have to hold them lightly and know that they are provisional, and then they don't hurt. Right. But the moment you take them, if you imagine a provisional statement of reality is reality, mm-hmm. you can feel that.
Yeah. And whereas a box around whereas the unboxable.
And that's why things like teachings like Vedanta and Advaita and whatnot are so satisfying in many ways, is because they don't. They're definitive. The right ones, the correct ones, are definitive, and so that and Buddhism as well. You know, they describe reality, and you don't bump into them within yourself. You go, yeah, of course, that's how it is. That's how it is. That's felt and known in the body, and so not just teachings, but.
However, I think you do bump into them if you're very much looking to the mind to understand what is being spoken to. You very right. much bump
yes.
into them.
I'm talking about the correlation between actual reality and the definitive descriptions of reality.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you've got an attachment to a particular viewpoint, that's Ooh. What it's bumping into, though. It's not bumping into reality. It's delusion bumping into delusion.
Exactly.
Grasping, oh no, I have this truth that I'm holding on to from the mind.
But here's the thing. Truth needs no protection.
No, absolutely.
So if there's a sense of protection around something, you can pretty much guarantee
something in there that needs to...
Something smells not right there.
Yeah,
then.
Exactly.
Because it's like, it's truth doesn't need protection. No. Truth can be poked and prodded and come at from any different direction, and it still remains true. And so there's no... It's funny...
Truth/reality. I mean, that's what you're talking
growing
about,
up
isn't
in,
it?
You know, in the way I did... There was a lot of claims of truth that were very needing to be very protective.
Taboo.
And
don't
it's like,
ask
can't
that
question.
Question.
That. And it's like, why not? If it really is truth, why can't you ask that question? Surely it remains true then. So actually, to me, that's where I've learned to use that as a bit of a radar.
Well, because a lot of people don't want truth. Most people don't want truth. They want comforting delusion.
And that's, that's again, it's
and
not
that's
to,
fine. It serves its purpose at its time.
Exactly. It's not to judge that. It's just if your compass point is set to truth, and again, you don't choose that, that's something that comes about and blossoms in the heart. People who find themselves, their compass point set to that, it's not easy.
You don't choose that. Reality is tough, but it's better to be in alignment with it conceptually and perceptually rather than fight it, because reality is going to win 100%
of
the time.
You meet a lot of sacred cows that, you know, it can be pretty brutal, pretty sort of stark when you meet a truth that against a sacred cow of a belief that's held. That can be quite a
That's why I think experience. That awakening is, you know, we talk about ultimate reality. I mean that in a technical sense. It's like, this is, you know, reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I one makes not as a claim that I need to protect. It's just go and find out. Yeah. There it is. Reality is reality. And so enlightenment or awakening is really just the a recognition and realization of reality as it is. It's not about adopting any worldview. It's just about...
Yeah, which is why it's interesting, you know, the ego is very quick to protect itself and very quick to flare. And to me, there again shows where there's needing of protection. Why is there needing of protection? Because it's not ultimately true.
No. They know it's vulnerable. So you have to fight a seeming attack on it.
So often when you are... getting closer to that truth. That's why the ego can often sort of flare up and rail against. And actually, you know, I see it time and time again, people actually having, you know, sort of mind attack, ego attacks. When you're getting closer to clarity of seeing in truth, there's a threat, a sense of threat that can come from the ego.
And that's perfectly understandable, right?
Totally, 100%.
If you believe yourself to be... But here's the thing, where did we get our initial sense of ourselves as separate beings? Childhood. We adopted... Mm-hmm.
Babies don't have it.
No, and toddlers don't for a while. And then it kicks in about two. And then they start to get them.
And you can watch it when you spend time around kids. Yeah. You can see kids of different ages. You can see where there's that shift that happens.
Yeah, and you know, we talked about this as well. That, you know, when you're a kid, it's a natural function of developmental growth that you develop a sense of yourself as a thing. But you know, this is the power of you know, awakening and enlightenment. These teachings as a developmental stage is you're like, oh, okay, those things I learned about who I am and what I am weren't absolutely true. So you get past and you go, well, there's an absolute truth, and it's okay to walk around and, you know, be called Martin or Imogen and whatever. And
because functionally it's great, you know, great shorthand.
I think DT Suzuki said something like, oh no, it wasn't one of the Suzukis, said, you know, do I need an ego? Just enough so you don't get knocked over by a bus, you know. It's
which, you know, speaks to, we didn't address it because it was addressed in the podcast that didn't go out last week. But we actually had another question, which basically, I won't go into the question.
We'll touch
but,
on it. It's,
but d- it's that. It's just, do I need a healthy ego? Do I need a healthy self-image?
Before I engage on
and there's the answer. Lightly so.
Yeah.
And the word of before I can go into awakening teachings. No, there is no before. No. There's no, you know, setting all the things in place before.
Yeah, don't kick the ball down the road by saying, "Oh, I'll do it once I've," you know. Well, I remember there was, you could buy this plate once as a joke plate, and it's called Around to It, and you'd give it to people who would say, "Hey, you know, when are you going to do this thing?" "I'll do it when I get around to it." And this plate was around to it, right? Around to it. This is a joke. And it's like that thing. If you put something, this idea that, oh, I first have to do this before I start self-inquiry. No, you start where you are with what you can.
Anyway, you can't. And so this, again, it suggests that there's an I that can choose and does choose.
Yes.
when the call of awakening happens. And yeah. it doesn't work that
no.
way.
No, that's it.
It's a nice comfort maybe to yeah. to an ego that feels that it is in control of this process.
But at the reality same time, is I'm not knocking, you know, I'm not saying that someone, let's say, kicking the ball down the road, so to speak. I'm actually not even judging that.
No. Sometimes that is what happens.
That is what happens. And that's absolutely necessary.
Yeah, some psychological,
perfect timing.
You know, therapy or these kind of things, which, you know, actually can end up supporting the awakening process, yeah. funnily enough,
yeah.
to do some of that self-work on the provisional person level
yeah.
is also necessary yeah. at some point.
Yeah, we literally get everything we need at yeah. every moment. Yeah. And it is, I would say, orchestrated towards returning home to our true nature.
Yeah. On all levels. This is the thing is like, it's not just on the absolute level. It is on the relative level that we awaken. It is on all levels. And what I mean by that is that it is embodied, that realization of your nature is also then an embodied realization of
yeah.
a living, breathing recognition in each and every moment.
Well, I wonder, I think, you see, I've been like reading and exploring the Christian theological world. It's all over the place, to be fair. But this idea of incarnation has been like the idea is Jesus as an incarnation. And you have people like Richard Rohr and Cynthia Bergeau saying, yes, but that's actually not exactly what was being posited. You know, the problem is that we said, oh, he was a unique incarnation of God and that we have to worship him rather than more of a demonstration of what the incarnation of spirit looks like, you know, what can look like.
Modeling what is possible.
You know, and this thought actually just came back to me the other day, this sense of, when we were talking about, you know, the difference perhaps, so I was talking about the, like, you know, awakening has stages. Like, there's, you know, there are initial awakenings. They're real. They're non-dual, you know, loosely speaking. The awareness of one's nature as consciousness. Okay, that's a big start. You know, the identity of the small self is superseded by, oh, the ground of being itself.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, that nominally excludes manifestation. And so the process going to, let's say, quotes, full enlightenment is the process of integration of, you know, silence and dynamism as recognized as the singular wholeness.
Yeah, the unity.
But what we've been talking about as well is emergent things like the quality of love and bliss. I mean, yeah. you use the word love more than I do. I use the word bliss more, but although love is, you know, they're kind of, right?
Yeah. Again, different facets of the same gem.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of kind of the same.
Kind of the same with maybe slightly different fragrance or different emphasis. But it is of the same
yeah.
for me.
But pointing towards this process, and we identified this the other day from my perspective, and I think to some degree you share this, to a large degree, there are... And I'm talking post-awakening, even though a lot of this applies pre-awakening, but in non-duality, in unity, post-awakening, there are...
Do you mean initial stages of awakening or mature?
Let's talk about initial stages to start with. That yes, the awareness is established as, let's say, self, but then there's this, what does Adyashanti call it? Manageable duality. Yeah. You know, there's manifestation and silent consciousness self. Those seem to be two things.
Objects of perception separate yeah. from subject, yeah,
Marshy, we should call it. The self is separate from activity.
Yeah.
But looking at the movements and the processes that I've experienced and witnessed, and is like the two movements of one, purification, which mm-hmm. is... the embodied, let's say, stresses or traumas or vasanas, whatever you want to call them, the almost pathological,
yeah.
you know, problematic almost incursions into the energetics of a system,
yeah,
start to release and open up.
Conditioning. Yeah, on the mind level, that would look like conditioning.
Correlating with the energetic level. Yeah, so absolutely. Though that's the purification, it's mind and body. And somatics. Yeah. So those tend to have an easier time naturally, spontaneously releasing as one is exposed, as life exposes you to the triggers that set them off.
Yeah. Nominally, we could call that integration or detoxing or purification.
But I would call it purification. So as a movement, it's a form of purification. But then there's the other one, which is refinement.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there's any more. There's not any more, but refinement.
Yeah. Which is, and again, we can use the words lightly because we could use lots of other words. Embodiment, I would use, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. But so I find like... the process of that is actually a rarefying of one's perception and one's lived experience. And
I would call it. You know, you have a lot of these teachings that are the ascent, which is that first awakening is, oh my gosh, that opening up, that vastness of being, recognizing I am the self, the vast, ineffable ground of being that is all, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's a very... typically used in the language of ascent language. And then there's a descent that happens. There's an embodiment. There's as you're using the word
refinement.
And it's that sort of consciousness filtering in through and as all layers. And
it gets very subtle. It's because I think you can wake up while still not having a perceptually subtle recognition of your own... inner manifestation, let's say, and that refinement can happen, and that's very transforming. And you hear this. I don't want to get into sort of creating, you know, spiritual ideals. There's enough of that around. But I was talking about things like saintliness and the light body and the refinement of this incarnation. That's what I talk about. You know, like, and it's funny, we talk about Jesus on the at some point he goes off onto the mountainside, and I think it's him and Moses and Elijah, is witnessed by one or two of the disciples or whatever, this report of suddenly they became like beings of light. They were still embodied, but somehow the quality of light,
and that is a thing,
and I think that's a part of this. It's not, we are spiritual beings, and what does that necessarily look like? Yes, it looks like nuts and bolts and stuff, but I'm curious to see not the end of that looks like, but what the continuing process of purification, refinement, and, you know, the condition of perfect surrender.
Yeah,
you know, what does that do to our bodies, and what does that do to the world that we seem to live in?
Exactly, and how does then, you know, the qualities as manifested in this individual, what is the full potentiality of this system, this mind body soul system that is embodied in this world? And I think that's what I see. I've watched happening with you, I've watched happening with me, I've watched happening with many others. It's like it past the integration and the deconditioning and the purification and the detox, there is another process that takes over. And it's not to say it's linear in terms of one then the other. They are, to me, they are very much hand in hand happening, you know, sometimes indistinguishably so. But there is this deepening into the expression of consciousness that you are embodied
throughout
as.
All the levels of manifest body, and
things come and online mind. that weren't available before, you know, subtleties that weren't noticed, experiences that went missed.
This is something that I've written about before. I haven't really spoken about it too much, a little bit. You know, when I first started getting into spirituality more earnestly, especially the idea of enlightenment, and liberation and what that looked like. I was first informed, and what set the tone for my seeking was a certain school of Buddhism, which was Theravada, let's say, or Hinayana, which is a bit of a pejorative term, but basically that sort of a nirvanic school of Buddhism, which traditionally is posited on the idea that, well, one, there is, life is more or less suffering. I don't want to paraphrase, because Buddha talked about the truth of suffering. He didn't say life is suffering, but basically the end goal is extinction. That life itself is just a cycle of suffering that you just want to get off.
Which in Vedic the terms there is something similar, no? Of this idea of like you reincarnate, and eventually you reach enlightenment and you don't reincarnate again.
Well, I'm not sure. I'll have to look more closely into that. Now,
that's just from my memory of childhood. I might be completely wrong in that memory, but that I guess, is my memory of being taught that, at least.
I guess what that set me up to think or even aim for is that, look, the answer to human suffering is just to not exist.
Yeah.
Right? Now, different newer, the Mahayana schools have a different view on that now, which is to say something like the Bodhisattva, which is like after death, even at the point of total enlightenment where one would be extinguished as such, there's a slight holding on to something just to continue to incarnate compassionately and to live in a world which, now I'm not even of even both of those viewpoints. And what I'm trying to say is they set me up in a particular way to view the world as a field of suffering that needs to be escaped. As a booby prize. Just get out of it. But that's actually not my experience anymore. And I don't see that as the sort of, I don't necessarily see that it, like, extinction is, okay, let me put it this way. You take something like Buddhism, life is a problem to be solved. Mm-hmm. You take something like Christianity, you know, in some more mystic sense, the incarnation, the embodiment is actually really important. Mm-hmm. How to live in and as love is a really important part of that. It's not a problem to be solved and that by not existing anymore. Now, I'm saying these teachings themselves, I'm not saying holding one of them more true than the other. I'm just saying in my experience, one of them set me up to see the human incarnation in a Gnostic sense as like life of this body is just an imposition.
I know.
It's a mistake. It's not.
Yeah. And it can certainly feel that way. I would say in those immature, I don't mean that pejoratively, but in those immature first moments of awakening, I'm not saying literal moments, but you know, those early days of awakening, it can feel a little bit like that. It's like, you know, what's the point of being
here? Yeah, what now?
I really remember strongly feeling that, actually.
Yeah.
Of like, is this it? Like, you know.
Yeah. What now?
What now? You know? But actually, it's not where I'm at now.
No.
I'm in totally fine. And I'm even more so recently just really finding life, to be in love with life.
Yeah.
To be.
Because it's not a mistake.
No.
I mean, it's not like, it's beautiful. Life's broken. It's like, no, come in. You know, the veil of tears becomes the garden of delight.
It is.
That's the, and that's the thing. You know, they say samsara is nirvana. Nirvana is samsara. Mm. So coming into that and living life, and life is, it can be a garden of delight.
It can be, and I didn't know it. I didn't know. This is taking years to come. But
only when grounded in.
I would say for me personally, it's taken years to for this, where I sit now, to be felt, it really felt. It's not an intellectual pursuit. No. It's like the heart just is completely in love with the sacredness of this life.
You can't reject the thisness of it. No. I mean, that's a mistake. It's the full embrace and allowance and welcoming and loving of this, whatever this is showing up to be.
But it doesn't come automatically for most. Some it does.
No, I think, I guess why I brought up that idea
was, I mean instantaneously, I don't mean automatically, instantaneously is what I meant.
Yeah, right, yeah. Good point. The reason I brought that up is to show that even if you're working through a spiritual tradition that in some sense is relatively pure and deeply insightful, you can carry a fundamental worldview over past awakening into awakening. You're not even quite it's not even quite clear that you've done it and that you've actually been set up to have a kind of a subtly nihilistic perception on what's real. Now, I don't know, right? I don't know anything past now. Yeah. This is it. But I had to shed that. I realized I had that worldview and I see a lot of it actually in working with people post-awakening, is that there can be a nihilistic stage that emerges. You've woken up to the self.
Really can.
And then you go, well, what's this about then? I'm done. Why am I still here?
Yeah. And the way I see that is it's like there's a falling back to that emptiness that initially happens.
Yeah.
And all of the objects are seen as sort of where prior they were seen as who and what you are, all the objects of perception are now seen as not it, not me.
Illusions.
Yeah. And so that's where that emptiness and that nihilism is born, I feel. That sense of, none of this matters. None of this is the self. And while not untrue, is like the way I would describe it is like turning up to a play and leaving it after the first act, after the intermission.
Yes.
You don't get to see
the other best is yet to come. It's like,
and it's not that at that point you're seeking the second act. It's just that if you get, quote, stuck, and again, it's not through fault of your own. It's not like you're doing that. But if there is a stuckness in that, which can often happen, as you're saying, as a leftover paradigm that has been brought subtly into your expectations, let's say, of awakening, that full dropping or that descent into the heart, that opening of the heart, I do feel that is a part of awakening, but won't necessarily happen to all, because if there is some leftover vestiges that
That's it. To say what next, what now, what's the point? Good reason why. I think that's partly in my experience. I think partly it was to do with my whole life had been organized and orientated around spiritual seeking, right? And seeking and just getting. And suddenly that was over because it was fulfilled. Yes. The seeking went.
Now what?
But that defined me, you know. So, you know, the death of the self, the ego death is also the death of all the orientations that the ego was engaged in for forever.
Yeah.
But you've got to give it time, haven't you?
You do, because then all of these orientations are taken away. And for a while that can feel,
the purification sometimes.
I used to call them my doldrum years of like, what am I good for? I'm good for nothing now.
Right.
But actually the way I see it is what then takes over is service. And that's the bodhisattva sort of view of like you then become an instrument of consciousness playing out. And I don't mean service in the very traditional view of service as in serving others. I mean service in terms of there is an emptying out of the person. There is an life, emptying out and a filling up of God, for want of a better word there.
Yeah.
There's a technical word for it. What is that?
Kenosis.
That's it. Yeah.
Self-emptying.
Yeah. So there's an emptying out of the personal self, and there's a filling up of this vehicle, this body, this mind becomes that vehicle, that embodiment by which consciousness, by which life, by which God is serving life. Not serving others, although it can look like that.
Well, they're included.
Yeah,
in that.
That's what I mean. I just want to.
But it's not
that,
so narrow as that.
Exactly.
It's not such a
narrow. Service in that very narrow terms. But I mean, and another word for this, surrender.
Yeah.
And another word for this, love.
Yeah.
And to me, there's where that descent happens, and that's where the opening of the heart happens. Mm. And that's where the maturity of awakening starts to take hold, is it's not my will be done, it's thy will be done. Mm. In terms of how life is playing out. And so, and that is pretty heady in my experience anyway, as a pretty, I don't mean heady in terms of fulsome experience.
Yes.
What's the word? Intoxicating. Yes. That's the word.
Absolutely.
It is a very, and this is where whenever people come to me, and I've had countless people come to me and like, where's the love? You know, I've had this awakening. Where's the love everyone talks about? Where's the bliss everyone talks about? And I'm like, you're not wrong. You're just not at that place where that is true in the experience.
Well, yet. I think that's the refinement. And yes, I think exactly. I remember sitting with someone and you asked that question, where's the love? And I was like, well, why don't you go and meet it then? Where is it? It's inside. Go in there, drop into yourself more fully. And, you know, there was awakening there, but somehow there was not like, okay, we'll drop into it, drop in. It's there, but you're not sunk into it to get the flavor of it. You're not
emptiness,
letting it permeate you.
Exactly. So in that emptiness, what you start to know, it's almost like going into a pitch black room and you think it's pitch black. So in that emptiness, pitch black room, nothingness. Mm. And that's beautiful. Yeah. When you've been a person and you're full of suffering and conditioning and all this, that emptiness is so freeing, it's so liberating, it's so beautiful. Mm. But you spend enough time in that pitch black room and what you notice, there's some objects going on in here. Mm. And it's like from that emptiness, all of life is born. All of existence is born. The fullness of life is known.
Yeah.
And that is love.
And I think the movement towards love, Maharshi used to talk about this, the movement in terms of his states of consciousness, waking, dreaming, sleeping, cosmic consciousness, God consciousness, and unity. Mm-hmm. You know, the early stages, let's say awakening, where the self is realized as consciousness itself, empty consciousness, and what's seen as separate somehow from you. But then this process between that and unity, you call it God consciousness or refined or refining consciousness, is a process of refinement whereby our perception naturally is quite gross. We see the surface, the senses.
We look at a table, we see a table, we feel a table. But
dropping into all that subtlety, and it becomes increasingly blissful. It becomes increasingly full of love and devotion and just full of the wonder of being itself. Yeah. And that's that process surrender of, let's say, refinement. Life. And so that surrender dropping through these subtler and subtler regions. And ultimately, the unity is the wholeness of the whole thing. It's just that, you know, but it's become subtle. Mm-hmm. And that kind of talking about the incarnation. What is it, you know, what does a full and full-bodied, matured spiritual incarnation look like? I think it's something more akin to light and love, that penetrates all the cells, orients all the systems of the mind-body manifestation.
And includes everything.
And includes everything.
Every expression of being. Mm-hmm. It's like, to me, the image that just came is it's the artist, obviously no entity of artist, but it is the principle of the artist painting with all the colors. And it's like consciousness paints with all the colors. And that's, I think, our birthright. What Jesus was modeling. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these other
people. And the saints, the sages of all traditions,
It's the recognition that all expressions of consciousness are available and possible to all.
Yeah. Okay. Let us wrap it up. that was lovely. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Yeah. Usual things like subscribe, share, all of that good stuff that everyone always says.
And
your questions are very much appreciated.
Yeah, much appreciated. That was a very fruitful jumping off point. So thanks for that question. Thanks for the questions.
But to the two questions. Yeah. We didn't directly quote the other question, but we got there.
Yeah.
And yeah, just really enjoying this conversation.
Great.
So, thank you.
Thank you. See you all soon. Bye for now.